When they were herded together in the corridor just before noon, Ryan maneuvered himself next to the armorer and talked intently to him, their heads close together. Christy watched, knowing that this was something that she could never share. She and Ryan were as close to each other as it was possible for any two human beings to be, but when it came to details of the arcane and intricate crafts of combat and death, Ryan would go to John Dix above all people. At least it showed a glimmer of hope in what she felt was an utterly bleak situation. As they were marched down, JB called out to Gateau.
Hey, Gateau! Sorry we didn't get to see the Baron's gun collection. Must be something special. Where's he keep it?
North Tower. You can get some satisfaction from the thought that all of your blasters are already up there, labeled and on show. But I guess you know that you won't ever be getting to see them yourselves.
Each of them had submitted to a cursory body check to make sure they weren't carrying concealed guns. Most of them had knives, but these were ignored. Baron Mandeville was waiting for them in the Great Hall, standing on a platform close to the main door, his hands behind his back. He looked as though he'd just come from a bath, with his white hair still damp, and the scent of perfumed oil surrounding him. He was dressed in a heightened version of antique fox-hunting clothes, crimson jacket, fawn jodhpurs tucked into highly polished riding boots, with short, blunt spurs. He had an unidentifiable revolver in a deep holster at his hip, and carried a silver-handled riding crop.
He stands there like he's waiting for his sled and reindeer to go and deliver Christmas presents.
Mandeville tapped the whip against the side of his boot.
The time has come, Outlanders.
Before the Baron could say anything else, he was aware that everyone was looking past him to a small staircase, where Marie stood looking at the assembly. She wore a simple white blouse with a ruffle of lace at her throat, black leather riding breeches so tight that they looked like they'd been sprayed onto her, and the same soft maroon boots she had on when they first saw her, with the same savage Mexican rowel spurs. Her gloves were scarlet leather, and she carried a vicious quirt. Her astounding hair was pulled back and tied with a ribbon of azure silk. Her slit eyes burned toward Michael, but he, to his great credit, held his nerve and smiled at her, then turned away and spat on the stone floor.
I hope you keep that courage after the hunt, when you and I are alone again.
Mildred gave Marie the finger.
Fuck you, lady. Let's get on with the sad and sorry charade, shall we?
The Baron gestured for his sec boss to tell Ryan and his friends what the rules of the game were. Outside the ville, they could all hear occasional rumbles of thunder, promising a return of yet another of the vicious chem storms that were whirling around Kansas. Through the tall windows, it was possible to see that the day had become darker.
You have a 15-minute start by my cron. You get to the main gate and go from there. Stay together or split up, doesn't matter. After the rain, there's no way you can hide your tracks from us. We come after you. Run or hide, up to you. We catch you, and you all get chilled.
He hesitated and glanced at Marie.
One way or another, fast or slow. Remember what I said to you, Carter.
Ryan nodded, saying nothing.
Any questions, Outlanders?
The Baron beamed at them as though he just wondered if anyone wanted more chestnut stuffing with their Thanksgiving turkey. Nobody spoke. JB observed the proceedings for the hunt with a dispassionate fascination.
I never saw so many sick men. Gonna leave the ville short.
Yeah.
I don't suppose there's any point in asking if they'll spare Dean, is there?
No. Ryan looked around him, seeing that the chem storm was not that far away, with lightning lacing the sky. The wind flurried, and Ryan felt a brief spatter of small rain in his face. Tasting it, he found that it didn't have the bitter acid tang of the previous storm. Both the Baron of Suncrest and his daughter had disappeared into the ville, no doubt to take some last-minute refreshment before hunting seven human beings to a brutish death. But dozens of Sekmen circled the courtyard, watching the prisoners. Harry Gateau stood among them, peering down at his cron in the gathering gloom.
Looks like you'll die wet, Carter.
I can live with that.
I reckon time's about up, Outlanders. 15 minutes from... now!
The chem storm was closing in around them as they ran away from the gates of the ville, grouped together, following on the heels of Ryan Carter. Off to the north, the sky was darkened by great bursts of rain sweeping down from high altitude. It looked like it would be on top of them within less than the 15 minutes start that they'd been given. The first target was to reach the fringe of the trees across the stone bridge, where the river was close to bursting its banks, taking them out of sight of any watchers within the shadowy windows of the ville. Ryan held up his hand as soon as they were safe, checking his chron.
1 minute and 22 seconds.
Why don't we try to get back to the redoubt?
Wouldn't make it. The point about this hunt is that there isn't any way we can win it. Whatever we do, they'll still write us down and chill us. They got the time, the men, and the blasters.
Ryan looked back.
You can't see us from here. Come on.
He turned sharply to the right and began to dodge between the pines, making sure there was always a fringe of the forest between them and the nearer walls of the ville.
We're going to try and get back in. Hot pipe, Dad!
Doc was always the one who found it difficult to travel fast over rough terrain.
Sneak into the lair of the great white worm itself. Your schemes are always a source of wonderment and delight to me, my dear Corder.
The idea had been triggered by the realization that Suncrest would be left distinctly short of Sekhmen once all of the hunters had left in the pursuit. But it was a plan laced with potential problems and opportunities for total disaster. They had to find a way into the fortified building, then get to the arms collection. If they could get that far, then the balance of power would tilt a little in their direction. After that... Ryan stopped again, checking his chron.
6 minutes and 40 seconds.
They were close to the main generator, where the river foamed and tumbled over the huge lichen-covered wheel. It was possible to make out the massive stone building through the trees, less than 100 paces away. Lightning crackled a few miles off, and a curtain of rain came sweeping down, veiling the walls of the ville itself, close beyond the generator. Under the spreading branches of the dense wood, the 7 companions remained dry. For the plan to have any chance of success, its timing was crucial. If they made their move too soon, then the hunt wouldn't have set off, and they might as well slit their own throats. If they left it too late, then they might well be tracked down before they could try to break into Suncrest. JB's face was a white blur in the Stygian gloom.
Rain will make tracking harder.
Gonna be around 100 riders, all bursting out of the main gate in about 6 minutes from now.
Ryan brushed away a spot of cold water that had already filtered through the dense foliage above him.
Bound to have dogs with him. But the scent won't be that strong, and they could easily get jammed up together on that main trail.
Should we have tried to cross the river? I've heard that hounds can't follow overflowing water.
River's flooded. Try to cross it and you get drowned. Better this way.
More lightning flashed, turning everyone into wide-eyed, pallid ghosts.
Won't help the dogs any.
5 minutes before they start after us.
What if they cheat and come early?
From what I've seen of Harry Gateau, he'll give the word when exactly 14 minutes and 60 seconds are up.
The only window in the mill that looked over the woods was high up. The blackening sky reflected off it, turning it into a blank mirror, making it impossible to see if anyone was on watch behind the dusty glass. The rain had now become torrential, and all of the friends were starting to get wet. For a brief moment, it crossed Ryan's mind to wonder whether the Mandevilles might abort the hunt, but he instantly dismissed the idea. He led the way closer to the pounding wheel. There was now so much noise from the raging water and from the storm around them that it was pointless to try to move with any stealth. He noticed a couple of tin wires running from the mill to the nearest point of Suncrest's walls, which he guessed was some kind of comm device. Ryan held up his hand, gathering everyone around him.
If they get a chance to warn the Sekhmen left in the ville, then we're done. We have to be triple fast.
2 minutes.
Now they were out of the cover of the pines, all of them soaked to the skin, pressed flat against the screaming granite walls. Here was the first step of the long, perilous road to safety. Ryan and JB counted down the last seconds. They both had knives drawn, as did the others, except Doc, who had unsheathed his sword stick.
15, 14...
8, 7, 6...
The lightning was purplish, streaked with a jagged pattern of neon pink, accompanied by the characteristic chemstorm smell of sulfur and ozone.
2, 1, go.
Ryan was first up the stairs, careful not to slip on the wet, slick slabs of gray stone. There was a huge oak door, studded with iron bolts, and a whorled brass ring the only way of trying to open it. He grabbed at the handle, feeling it squirm away from his damp fingers. Then he had it, He turned it to the left, aware of the latch lifting. The place was throbbing with the ceaseless vibration of the great wheel turning, powering the generators that provided the mill with its electricity. The hall of the mill was deserted, with a staircase winding toward a higher floor. Ryan was aware that the clock was now running against them, ticking off their lives as the hunt began its remorseless pursuit. The noise was so all-pervading that it seemed to numb the other senses. Ryan sprinted up the angled stairs, rounded a corner, and found himself almost on top of a pair of men in maroon overalls. They had their backs to him and were sitting at a long bank of dials and gauges. It wasn't a time for hesitation. He had the Panga out in a flash and hacked the head off the shoulders of the servant on the left, while JD, with one of his pair of thin stilettos, stabbed the other in the heart. Neither victim could have known what hit them. The blood fountained from the gashed neck of the one man as Ryan raced halfway up the next flight of stairs, the armorer right behind him. Reaching the very top of the mill, they checked every side room and dusty landing. JB looked around the attic, under the eaves of the echoing building.
Empty.
Right. Let's go wreck the power controls, then head for the mill. Break everything you can. Everything. Is there a master control that'll jam the wheel?
Do that and the mill could come apart. Most frightfully dangerous, my dear fellow.
I'd never have guessed it was this lever.
It was set in the outer wall, a great steel bar 6 feet long, painted a brilliant red. It was dusty, showing that it had hardly ever been used. The piece of card above it was also faded by the passage of time. Warning, this breaks main wheel axle. Only use in emergency on direct order of Chief Miller. Do not engage while power is being generated. Peeling off the gray stones to the right of the big lever was another larger notice, which simply blared in large crimson capital letters the single word, danger. JB looked at it carefully, then turned and gave Ryan one of his rare smiles.
Best get everyone else outside except you and me. Could be sort of exciting.
Why?
Like going flat out on a war wagon and then throwing her straight into reverse.
No arguments. Wait around the corner out of sight of the mill. Christy, get the overalls off that dead man and give them to me.
The one without... No, of course. Too much blood.
Wilbert helped Christy as they stripped the stabbed man, tossing the maroon garment to Ryan.
Great. Now wait out there.
He struggled into the overalls, finding them a tight fit over his coat. But it would only be for a moment's extra time. A moment that might be vital.
Right. Let's do it, JB. See what happens.
They both gripped the lever, feeling it vibrate at their touch, as though it were connected to the heart of some monstrous beast dwelling in subterranean caverns. It was very stiff, and it took all of their considerable joint strength to shift it.
More!
The steel bar jerked, almost pulling itself from their hands, but they clung on, forcing it farther.
Fire blast!
The lights in the mill flickered, came back on again with a desperate brightness, then dimmed once more.
A bit more!
They threw everything at it, finally wrenching the control all the way down. The lever flopped out of their hands like a broken-backed snake and clattered to the floor. All of the lights went out. Ryan was first out to join the others, feeling clumsy in the borrowed clothes, blinking in the downpour. He glanced once more at his cron.
The hunt's been on for nearly 2 minutes, but they won't be organized yet. Time for us to try the bill. So far, so good, friends.
Suncrest was in pitch darkness, but none of the hunting party had the least idea that there was anything wrong. They had surged from the main gates of the ville into the teeth of the chemstorm. As Ryan Carter had predicted, the weather had produced chaos for the dozens of riders and their baying pack of dogs. Two of the leading segment's mounts went down on the cobbles of the inner yard as soon as the signal was given, bringing down another 10 in flailing person confusion. By the time some sort of order had been restored, helped by the savage whip of Mistress Marie, they were out near the edge of the forest in reasonable discipline, but nearly 2 whole minutes had been wasted. Despite the raging chemstorm, they all knew that time was still massively on their side, and not one of the huge gang of sweating-soaked hunters was worried. Well, perhaps one. Sixth Sergeant Harry Guiteau had a strange nagging doubt at the back of his mind, a doubt that made him push his men on into the forest. He allowed the hounds to run free as they tried to pick up a scent from the sodden mud underfoot. Marie Mandeville was riding like a fury, her long black hair already streaming water, the flanks of her stallions speckled with crimson goblets, where the Mexican spurs were doing their vicious work. Her father was jogging comfortably along, beaming at all of his men. There was utter confusion for at least two more minutes, where the trails parted, until the bellowing of a group of the hounds showed they'd finally caught a scent. One of the pretty boys rode as close to Marie as he dared.
"Down the river!"
Everyone set off toward the stone bridge at a flailing gallop. Gateau spat out a mouthful of cold rainwater.
"Didn't figure traitors, man, for a double stoop. No way."
Suncrest was in total darkness. The door stood at the base of the North Tower, with its ornate Gothic pinnacles and mullioned windows. An electric sec alarm was at its center, as well as a large iron knocker in the shape of a bear's paw. Ryan lifted the knocker and let it fall. Nothing happened. He hammered again with the knocker. The maroon overalls were soaked through, their color almost black. Ryan gripped his panga in his right hand, concealed behind his back. JB was flattened against the wall to his left, the others lined up behind him, ready for the move if someone opened the door. If nobody let them in, then survival could be measured in short minutes.
"Maybe we better run for it, Dad!"
Ryan ignored Dean's worried voice. There was a small, barred ob window in the side of the door, and it finally slid back. All Ryan could see was a white oval of a face peering at him.
"The mill's broke! The power's down! Gotta check inside before Baron Nathan comes back. Quick, open up! Open the fucking door! You can be the one that tells Baron and Mistress why the Ville's blacked out!"
The moment the door began to move, Ryan hurled his shoulder against it, pushing in, so that the invisible person inside was knocked off balance. Ryan stabbed with the panga, using the broad point, feeling it jar against solid flesh. He twisted his wrist, giving the blade a savage jerk as he withdrew it. Blood gushed hot over his wrist, and he felt the life drain away at his feet. Everyone was jostling around Ryan, and he was aware of JB pushing past him, across the narrow hallway, and cautiously easing open the stout door beyond that led into the rest of the ville. There was nobody on the bottom floor of the North Tower, and they climbed quickly to the next level, past priceless tapestries showing medieval hunting scenes. JB was in the lead, keeping flat against the wall, trying to avoid the oak treads of the broad stairs. Not that anyone was likely to hear creaking floorboards over the noise of the chemstorm. On the second floor, there weren't any lamps lit, nor were there any sec men or servants. JB stared back into the pit of blackness.
"Where are the damned blasters?"
Ryan had automatically taken up the dangerous position of rear guard, and he stopped a moment.
"Gateau said they were in this tower, didn't he?"
"Try the next floor."
Christie was right. The precious gun collection of Baron Nathan Mandeville was on the third floor, where several emergency lamps had been lit, and where three sec men were waiting. Some of the dogs picked up the trail of the fugitives, leading toward the watermill, but most of them had missed the cutoff and were still racing excitedly on through the downpour, vanishing from sight. Two horses were down in the confusion. The rest of the riders bottled up and panicking.
"Order! Let's have some goddamn order!"
The three sec men were all standing on the landing, carrying several unlit oil lamps, two of them with glowing tapers. JB spotted them and retreated without being seen, beckoning to Ryan to join him near the top of the stairs.
"That overall could get you the few steps you need."
"We'll start coming before those bastards even work out who I am. It's not going to be much time for this. Let Doc follow one third. His sword stick could be just what we need here."
There was no point in waiting for a better time or a better chance. Ryan gathered himself, slipping the panga out of sight behind his back, and powering himself up the last few steps and onto the landing at a dead run. The guards were less than 20 feet away from him, slowed by their burden. One turned, spotting the maroon clothes, and started to smile.
"Been outside in the rain and..."
and died. Ryan slashed the sec man's throat open, then lunged at the chest of the second uniformed man, who went to meet his maker, puzzling over whether he should try to drop the valuable pre-dark lamps before unslinging the armalite from his shoulder. JB tried to stab the third guard, who parried the blow with one of the brass lamps. His mouth was opening to shout for help when Doc killed him with one savage thrust of his rapier, piercing the man's heart.
"Stamp on those lights, Dean."
Ryan watched as the boy quickly trod out the naked flames from the tapers, before they had time to ignite the pool of spilled oil that reeked among the broken glass of the lamps. There was a neat sign in ornate lettering, nailed to the wall at the entrance to a room that resembled the picture gallery, the Nathan Mandeville Armory. A couple more oil lamps stood on a wooden table a little way into the long room, both lit. Ryan picked up one, JB took the other.
Let's get our blasters back.
Sec Sergeant Harry Gateau eventually managed to heal his horse nearer to the mounts of the Baron and his daughter. During the time it took him, he'd also checked his cron. Close to 10 minutes had elapsed since he'd given the Outlanders the signal to run for their lives. 10 minutes that had been nothing but a bedlam of noise, rain, and uncontrollable animals.
Baron!
What is it?
Mandeville's white beard had lost its spring and curl, and now looked like some desperate Arctic animal clinging to his chin for protection. The merry little blue eyes were like chips of ice.
I can't see the lights in the mill.
So what?
Gateau suddenly realized that his lord was way beyond any sort of sense or reason.
So I think Cordar's fucked the power mill.
Bastard liar!
Mandeville swung at his face with the crop, the barbed steel tip missing Gateau by less than an inch as he swayed back out of range.
Imbecile!
Don't you talk to me like...
He visibly shrunk as he met his daughter's eyes.
Gateau.
Lady?
I believe you're right.
I can take a few good men and go to the mill.
We'll come with you. Take 20, no more, and send the rest of the blundering stoops back to the main gate. Tell them what might have happened. I think they're going for their blasters. We might still be in time to cut them off at the mill.
There was no other sign of life within the mill, as the seven companions moved slowly into the entrance of the gallery, the two lamps casting pools of yellow light for a few yards ahead and behind them. Ryan told Michael, as their best hand-to-hand fighter and fastest mover, to remain behind on the dark landing with the spilled oil and the three corpses, to listen for any sign of danger. JB was showing more emotion than Ryan had ever seen from the sallow-faced armorer. Twice he stopped, putting down the smoky lamp to wipe his spectacles again.
We gotta move quick, JB.
Of course.
The room that seemed to be at least 40 paces in length was simply filled with armaments. There were all manner of bows, spears, swords, and daggers, dating from every period of history, all jumbled together in the same way that the collection of paintings had been, and guns of every shape, size, and age. At any other time, Ryan would have happily spent a full day in savoring the weapons. But now there was only a snatched moment to glance at anything that particularly caught his eye. Some had neat labels pasted beneath them in their display cases, but many more had little or no information. An 1860 Henry, a unique Genhart repeating rifle with its revolving cylinder placed horizontally on its top, a trim breech-loading Derringer made by David Williamson over 200 years earlier, a Gerngross breech-loader. J.B. shook his head at a wonderful example of a Kentucky musket that dated from way back before the Revolutionary War. Dean admired a magnificent Sharps Buffalo rifle.
Can't we take some new blasters, Dad?
No. They said that our own weapons are up here. We take those and then get out.
My God, what are these?
J.B. skidded to a halt and brought the lamp back to see what Mildred had been admiring. The case contained a number of tiny little guns, smaller than a man's palm, with a hole through their engraved butts.
Knuckle dusters. Single shot. Fire one bullet, anything from a .22 right up to a big .44. Accurate up to about 18 inches.
Christy kept looking over her shoulder to where Michael was keeping watch.
I think they're coming. They're not inside the ville yet, but it won't be long.
Skydark. The best blasters in the whole of the Deathlands, and I can't even look at them.
Now, conscious of the increasing pressure, Ryan began to walk faster. His good eye caught familiar and unfamiliar names as he passed the rows of oiled and gleaming metal. Colt, Astra, Browning, Detonix, Cimarron, Smith & Wesson, Beretta. The list went on, a litany of all that was wonderful about the world of pre-dark blasters. There were revolvers, shotguns, rifles, automatics, machine pistols, and even an LMG tripod mounted. A couple of Gren launchers made JB hesitate.
No ammo. Here's our blasters.
Everyone ran to join him, Doc bringing up the rear. Ryan beckoned for Michael to leave the landing and retrieve his own centerfire 38. The storm had eased for a couple of minutes, but now it came surging back with renewed violence. Ryan felt fully dressed at last, with his Sig Sauer in his right hand, the blood-stained Panga sheathed once more. The Steyr was slung over his shoulder, and he was ready to go. JB worked the action of the Uzi, his head to one side, listening critically.
Needs field stripping and oiling.
He placed the Smith & Wesson M4000, flechette-firing scatter gun, across his back.
Ah, here's my trusty Lamar.
Dean flourished his massive 9mm Browning high power, the metal shining in the warm golden glow of the two oil lamps. Christy and Mildred both gripped their blasters, grinning at each other. The odds were just about what they'd been a few minutes ago, and the danger was even more intense, but now they could give a good account of themselves.